Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. I want you to just, for a second, picture a medical breakthrough. You know, the way we see it in the movies. It's some genius in a lab coat, late at night, staring at a screen.
Right, and they see it. The one mutation that changes everything.
It's this triumph of pure science. But here's the thing. If we're looking at the reality, I mean, here in 2026, the single biggest factor, the thing that decides if that breakthrough actually reaches a patient, it's not the scientist. It isn't the doctor either.
No, it's the antitrust lawyer, the one sitting in a boardroom maybe 3,000 miles away.
It's the lawyer. And they're navigating this regulatory minefield that has just become radioactive in the last couple of years. We talk all the time about the science of genomics, but we almost never talk about the business of genomics.
And right now, you could argue that the business side is setting the pace for the science side more than any lab equipment ever could. We're seeing this fundamental tension. Competition, you know, it's supposed to drive innovation. It makes companies better, faster, cheaper. That's the whole idea.
That's the theory anyway.
But we are seeing the dark side of that now.
Yeah.
When competition policy gets, well, when it gets unpredictable, science just goes underground. People stop sharing data.
We're sort of calling this the startup apocalypse. I want you to imagine someone with us today. Let's call her Maya. She's a brilliant founder, has a little startup, and she's developed a genetic test that's better than anything out there.
A decade ago, her path would have been crystal clear.
Exactly. Prove the science. Get acquired by a giant like Roche or Illumina and, you know, sail off into the sunset while her test helps millions.
That was the playbook. The Silicon Valley dream.
But today, here in 2026, that exit door is just nailed shut. The government is blocking the acquisitions.
The IRS is blocking the spinoffs.
And Maya is just stuck. She has this amazing test that she can't afford to scale up.
And the real irony is, we're a year into a new administration that literally promised to burn red tape. Everyone was expecting massive deregulation.
Right.
But in this one, very specific, very high stakes world of genetic antitrust, the red tape hasn't been cut at all.
It's been replaced with barbed wire.
Mm-hmm.
To help us untangle all this, we're doing a deep dive on a really critical perspective piece. It's titled Competition in Human Genetic Technologies, the Current U.S. Legal Landscape.
And this comes from a team at Penn State University. Abdullah Rashid, Nicole A. Rinkin, Nathan Riani, and Jennifer K. Wagner.
Yeah, and we should be really clear here. This isn't a wet lab study with pipettes and gels.
No, not at all. This is more like a survival guide for the C-suite. It's an analysis of how the Department of Justice, the FTC, and even the IRS have kind of encircled the whole biotech industry.
So let's start with the big question. Why does the government suddenly care so much about who's buying whom in the genetic space?
Well, the 23andMe bankruptcy in 2025 was a massive, massive wake-up call.
For data privacy, right.
It was the catalyst. When 23andMe went under, the big question wasn't about their science. It was, what happens to the database?
All that personal data.
You had the genetic codes of millions of Americans just sitting on a server, and suddenly it's an asset in a bankruptcy sale.
Mm.
The government realized that if the wrong person, or, you know, a hostile actor, gets their hands on that data, the implications are just catastrophic.
And that gets to this idea of market power, doesn't it? It's not just about one company raising prices.
No, it's bigger. If one company owns the sequencing technology and all the data that comes off it, they basically control the future map of human health.
And then there's the national security angle.
That's the other side of the vice. We saw a whole series of executive orders in 2024 and 2025 targeting bulk sensitive personal data.
So the DOJ isn't just asking if a merger is bad for consumers. They're asking if it lets our genetic data flow to countries of concern.
Exactly. So our founder, Maya, isn't just up against economic regulators. She's dealing with national security reviews.
Okay, but to actually stop these deals, the regulators need a legal toolkit. They can't just say, we don't like this one.
No, they have to use the statutes.
And we all know the big one, the Sherman Act from 1890, the granddaddy of it all.
Right, Section 2. The anti-monopoly law.
But trying to apply a law written for oil barons in 1890 to, you know, 2026 bioinformatics, that seems like a bit of a stretch.
It is a huge stretch, and that's why they've gotten creative. They're leaning much more on things like the Clayton Act, and especially the HSR Act.
The pre-merger notification rules?
Yes. That one is critical because it forces companies to show their cards. You have to tell the government before you merge.
But the real shift, as the paper points out, isn't the laws themselves, it's the interpretation, especially around horizontal versus vertical mergers.
This is such a key point.
Let's break that down, because it's so important for Maya's situation. A horizontal merger is the obvious one, right? Coke buying Pepsi.
Two direct competitors. In our world, that'd be like Thermo Fisher trying to buy Keegan.
An easy no from the regulators.
For decades, yes. It just consolidates the market, kills competition. It's an easy block for the FTC.
But the new battleground is vertical mergers, a company buying a supplier or a customer in its chain.
And historically, economists actually loved these. Yeah. They saw them as efficient. You know, a car company buys a steel mill, the cars get cheaper.
That was the thinking.
That was the prevailing wisdom, yes. Yeah. Until Illumina and Grail, that single case basically tore up the old playbook for our industry.
Okay, let's unpack that because it is the absolute heart of this paper. Illumina is the giant. They make the sequencing machines.
They dominate the market for the hardware.
And Grail makes a test, a multi-cancer early detection or MCED test that runs on those Illumina machines.
And Illumina actually spun Grail off back in 2016, then tried to buy it back in 2020.
A classic vertical merger on paper. Illumina is the supplier, Grail is the customer.
But the FTC jumped in. And they used a legal theory called foreclosure.
Foreclosure, meaning if Illumina owns Grail, they'd have this huge incentive to just crush all of Grail's competitors.
Precisely. If you're another little startup making a cancer test, you need Illumina's machines to do your work.
So you'd be buying your most important equipment from your biggest rival.
And the FTC argued that Illumina could just subtly squeeze you. Delay shipments, raise the price of servicing, you know, things that are really hard to prove but would kill your business. They could foreclose the market to everyone but Grail.
Illumina saw this coming, though. They made what they called the open offer.
They did. They put it in writing. We promise for 12 years to treat everyone the same. Same price, same service, same access.
Which sounds fair. Why wasn't that enough?
Because it's a nightmare to police. The FTC and the courts later on basically said these kinds of behavioral remedies are impossible to enforce.
How do you prove a shipment was delayed on purpose?
You can't. Or that a key software update went to Grail 2 weeks before it went to you. The government just decided it's easier to block the whole merger than to try and referee the behavior for a decade.
So in June 2024, Illumina was forced to divest Grail. They had to sell it.
And that sent a massive shockwave because it effectively killed the vertical integration growth strategy for the entire industry.
It was a clear signal. The government sees nascent competition, these tiny startups that might be a threat someday, as sacred.
And the big fish are not allowed to just swallow them anymore.
Which brings us to this political paradox we're in now, in 2026, which I just find fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
We're a year into the Trump administration. The whole platform is deregulation. There was an executive order, 148267, in April 2025 called Reducing Regulatory Barriers.
And yet, here we are.
Exactly. You would have thought the FTC would back off completely. But the new chairman, Andrew Ferguson, a Trump appointee, he kept the strict 2023 merger guidelines. He didn't tear them up.
It seems counterintuitive, but it makes sense if you look at the broader political shift. This isn't about left versus right on antitrust anymore.
It's more like populist versus corporate.
Exactly. There's a strong feeling in both parties that big tech and big bio have too much power. So even in a pro-business administration, they are surprisingly anti-monopoly when it comes to market concentration.
So the populist right and the progressive left sort of met in the middle on this idea that one company shouldn't own everything.
It's the horseshoe theory of politics playing out in real time. And if you're a CEO, that's terrifying. You can't just look at who's in the White House to predict if your deal will survive. The scrutiny is here to stay.
Okay, so let's go back to Maya in her garage. She knows she can't get bought by Illumina. The FTC will block it. So she thinks, okay, plan B.
Right, maybe merge with another company her size or have a big company spin off a division to join with hers.
And that is when the IRS shows up to kill plan B.
This is the part of the paper that I think will surprise a lot of people. We're so focused on the DOJ and FTC.
But the Treasury Department quietly tightened the screws in January 2025.
They did, on spinoffs. Normally, a company can spin off a division as a separate entity, and it's a tax-free event. That's a huge incentive. But these new IRS rules, they tighten the definition of what they call a device.
A device? That sounds like something from a spy movie.
In tax law, it basically means a transaction that's just a trick to get money to shareholders without paying dividends tax. The IRS now wants much stricter proof that a spinoff is a real business necessity, not just a tax dodge.
And they added a ton of new reporting requirements, didn't they?
Years of extra paperwork. So if you're on a board of directors, you see a huge risk of an audit and a good chance your tax-free status gets denied, so you don't do the spinoff.
So the merger market is frozen, and the spinoff market is frozen.
And Maya has no exit strategy left.
This is the core of the problem, the venture capital logic. People might hear this and think, well, so what? Maya should just build her own company.
But that takes hundreds of millions of dollars in capital. And VCs are not charities. They invest money to make more money.
They need a liquidity event, an IPO or an acquisition, usually in 5 to 7 years.
And if the FTC is blocking acquisitions and the market's too shaky for an IPO, the VCs just don't write the checks in the first place.
It becomes what they call a kill zone.
That's the term. If you're a startup in a sector where the exit path is blocked, you are in the kill zone. The capital dries up. So Maya's innovation doesn't just fail to sell, it fails to even get started. It dies in the garage.
So what's the alternative? The paper suggests that maybe big companies just go back to the old model, in-house R&D.
They'll certainly try, but we need to be realistic about the economics of that. Developing a new diagnostic from scratch costs, what, around $879 million and can take 10, 15 years?
And big companies are just slow. They're great at scaling and selling things, but that initial spark of discovery.
They're risk-averse. A startup is a speedboat. Big Pharma is an aircraft carrier. You can't just turn an aircraft carrier on a dime to chase some new idea.
And there's another problem with doing it in-house, getting the talent.
Yes, the best minds. But the whole legal framework around employment has also become a roadblock.
You mean non-competes? I remember back in 2024, it really felt like they were dead. The FTC issued a rule to ban them everywhere.
It was a very brief moment of hope for employees, but the court struck it down. A court in the Northern District of Texas ruled the FTC had overstepped its authority.
So that ban is gone?
Effectively, yes. By late 2025, the FTC had given up on the nationwide ban. So if you're a top scientist at a big firm, you are almost certainly bound by a contract that says you cannot leave and start a competing company for 1 or 2 years.
It all just comes full circle then. You can't quit your job to start a company because of your non-compete.
If you do somehow start one, you can't get funding because VCs are scared.
And if you beat all those odds, you can't get acquired.
It's a closed loop. And I think what the authors are doing here is waving a big red flag. They're saying, look, preventing monopolies is a noble goal. We all want that.
Of course.
But if the policy is too aggressive, we risk just fossilizing the entire industry.
It's the difference between a neat, tidy garden and a wild forest. The regulators want a garden where no single plant gets too big.
But innovation, real messy innovation, happens in the forest. And patients need what grows in the forest.
So let's try to put a bow on this. We've walked through the Sherman Act, the Illumina case, the IRS rules, non-competes. What is the actual state of the union for genomics innovation in early 2026?
The state of the union is, I'd say, paralysis by analysis. Companies are so scared of triggering a government review that they're sitting on their cash. We are moving into an era of build it yourself or don't build it at all.
Which sounds good, build it yourself, but in fields like cancer detection, every year you delay matters. Speed is life.
That's the fundamental trade-off. We might prevent a monopoly in 2030, but in the process, we might delay a cure that could have been ready in 2028.
It's a heavy thought. We think of 2026 as this futuristic time, but in some ways we've gone backwards. We're in this rigid system where the big players stay big, not because they're innovating, but because nobody else is allowed to get into the castle.
The drawbridge is up.
I want to leave our listeners with one final thought to chew on. We've spent this deep dive talking about the legal walls that have been built. We know the Grail test made it out, despite all the fighting. But what about the next Grail? If the path from a lab bench to a patient now runs through a 3-year DOJ investigation and an IRS audit, how many other life-saving ideas are just gathering dust in a garage right now because the business model itself has been made illegal?
That is the question that should keep us all up at night.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now, stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you just heard about. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
contracts on the table, draw another kind of line. A promise turns to leverage, a shortcut turns to lock. We hear the ticking footsteps of the deal about to knock.
When the market meets the microscope tonight.